This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free Blackstone 8-piece accessory kit when you buy a Blackstone 28-inch griddle. Plus, get two free select Craftsman V20 tools when you buy an RP brushless drill and impact driver combo kit. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Today's episode is brought to you by Pluto TV. Pluto TV is the leading free streaming television service. You can watch over 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all for free. No credit card needed. No sign up. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies. What are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again. Download Pluto TV for free on all of your favorite devices today.
There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome into another edition of Beyond the Darkness. I'm Tim Dennison for Dave Schrader. It is a Saturday, and normally you would get supernatural news, but it's Memorial Day weekend, and you're probably starting your summer by tying your kids to the radiator, or I don't know, you're probably having Child Protective Services called on you if you're tying your kids to the radiator, or you're probably on your way to a cabin, or you're probably... I don't know, you're doing family things, or maybe you're going to Las Vegas because it is AEW Double or Nothing weekend. I almost screwed that up. Or you're hanging out with our friend Chris Jericho. It's his match is tonight, so congrats to AEW for their inaugural weekend. We got to say what's up to AEW. We've got an exciting weekend of shows as for Memorial Day weekend. We're doing some remembering ourselves. We have two great shows in store for you this weekend. Today's show, as I hit my microphone, today's show has to do with Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum. And we are going to be analyzing Bigfoot and talking about whether Bigfoot is a real thing or not. And the case for Bigfoot and how you can tell if Bigfoot is indeed a real creature or not. So what I've done is I actually have quite the cool little gift I got from a friend of ours, Amanda Lamb Hoffman. So what up, Amanda? She's over in Madison, Wisconsin. And Dave has one of these too, but I haven't had a chance to give it to him yet because he's been on the road for so long. But here, this is actually kind of cool. You can look this up. It's called the Archie McPhee Emergency Bigfoot. I think it's like a call is what it is. It's battery operated. You have a howl. That's the howl. You have a snort. Yeah, you got a roar. And you got a groan. Ooh, that just sounds like a bowel movement that didn't happen. Yeah, poor Bigfoot. So I'm going to celebrate with my emergency Bigfoot call here. And by the way, on the back of the package here, it says, this is not a toy. So I bet you they think it's real. And there's a big box, too, that says not a toy. But I'm playing with it like it's a toy. So I'm going to be armed with this thing for the entire show. And at least in the background, every time Dr. Meldrum says something provocative about Bigfoot, I'm just going to sit in the background and go, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. So without further ado, let's get to it. Here's the first half of the program with myself and Dave and Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum right here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Good evening. Welcome to the best in paranormal talk radio. Darkness Radio is on the air. Bigfoot, Tim. There's so much interest in this character. I mean, from the onset of the, I keep wanting to call it the Zapruder film, from the onset of the Patterson-Gimlin film and the popularity surrounding it and all of the TV shows that have shown that framed footage, I've got to guess, you know, I say it jokingly, but I got to guess the Patterson-Gimlin film has been viewed and reviewed as much, if not as the same amount as the Zapruder film for JFK.
Oh, I'd agree, yeah.
There have been people around the world who have broken this video down in every way, shape, and form and tried to make sense of what it is that we're seeing in here and trying to separate fact from fiction. Is this, in fact, a hoax? Is this a possibility? Is it a reality? One of the people we've had an interest to meet with at a few different events throughout the years, and somebody who I really enjoy speaking with just on a one-on-one basis because he always has such a unique perspective to bring to this, is our guest for the next 2 hours. Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum is with us. He's a full professor of anatomy and anthropology and a professor of the Department of Anthropology at Idaho State University. Certainly one of the things, when you look up Bigfoot, one of the people that you will find involved in the research, study, and understanding is Dr. Meldrum. I find it fascinating that your name is attached to the Bigfoot research and investigations, Dr. Meldrum. And I think it's great that as somebody involved in science and understanding where we come from and our place in humanity on this planet, I'm glad that it's, you know, that science does take a hard-edged look at this. What drew your attention to the study of Bigfoot?
Well, it was a number of things. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and so I was exposed to some of the stories. And as you mentioned, the Patterson-Gimlin film played a significant role. I was about 11 years old when Roger Patterson came through Spokane, Washington, where I lived at that time, and showed his documentary that showcased that 60 seconds of film, and already being interested in primates and cavemen and everything, you know, prehistoric and mysterious, it made a huge impression at that time. But it was much later, as my professional career sort of took shape, that the interest became had more of a context within the framework of science, and coming face to face with a very distinct and lengthy set of footprints likewise made another kind of impression, I guess you could say, on my mind at that time. And the implications of those remarkably fresh and clear, unmistakable footprints in the mud were quite profound. I remember sitting there thinking, you know, do I really want to go down this road? But how could I not? I mean, my interest professionally was in the evolution of human bipedalism, and all of my research up to that point had focused on the adaptations of the human foot and the evidence of the timing and the pattern of emergence of those characteristics that distinguish us from other primates in that unique way. And so these tracks and all the other footprints that had been accumulating, you know, constitute probably the most prolific body of evidence that makes this more than just a collection of stories. That has a real significant role to play, which unfortunately many of my colleagues, because of the nature of the phenomenon of the question, have refused to engage in an objective and inquisitive way. Although that's changing, you know, I see a lot more behind the scenes than your you know, many in your audience, those who whose exposure to Bigfoot in large measure is limited to documentaries and reality TV shows. There's a lot more going on behind the scenes. A lot of conversations, a lot of interest, especially in the upcoming generation. You know, sometimes it takes a whole turnover of an entire generation before an idea can catch a hold and get some traction, and that's beginning to take place.
there is science that looks at our place and where we come from, and we have a limited, it seems to me, a limited understanding. We say that, oh, we evolved from this, we moved to here. Then we hear things like missing links. There's gaps where it doesn't seem to make sense of how evolution jumped from one place to another. And that's what we, as a lot of the lay people, understand. As somebody who actually has an understanding of anthropology, are there truly missing links? Are there really gaps? Or how do we understand that?
Well, certainly. The term missing link, in fact, came from, it's kind of an archaic term, and it sometimes is misleading. It, you know, back in the time in pre-evolutionary thought, as biologists were beginning, and many of these were clerics, often it was the clergy who had the time to pursue, and the patronage, to pursue the study of natural history. And they sought to reveal the order of God's creation, and they saw this as a great, what they call a great chain of being. But it was clear that we didn't that civilization didn't have a full understanding of that creation, and so there were links that were missing from this great chain of being. Particularly, for example, there must be something to fill that tremendous void that existed, that would seem very obvious, between humans and the rest of nature. And remember, at that time, you know, in Western Europe, or Western Europe, yeah, there were, the types of wildlife, the types of animals that your average person came and encountered or into contact with were barnyard animals, farm animals. And so there seemed to be a tremendous void. Any knowledge of man-like primates was just beginning to be realized, and even in the 18th century. And so those were the missing links. Now, obviously, today we have in science we have an evolutionary perspective, a notion of the origin of species and descent with modification from pre-existing species. And much of what we understand about that comes from the fossil record. And we recognize that the fossil record is very, very spotty. Now, this is something that in human evolution has really just taken a little bit of a different turn, just in the course of my career. When I was a graduate student, there was a notion called the single species hypothesis that was just kind of starting to crumble. The foundation upon which that rested as in terms of human evolution was beginning to succumb to new ideas, but the notion was simply anthropologists had borrowed a principle from ecology called the competitive exclusion principle. That was simply noting that no two species could occupy a single niche. One would do it better than another, and drive the other to extinction. You know, this had been demonstrated with microorganisms.
Mm-hmm.
Gauss had used paramecium. And shown, you know, you could grow two colonies of paramecium in the same medium. They were happy campers there, and they grew quite well. But you put them together in that same medium, and very rapidly, one of the species would become extinct. The other would prevail. So anthropologists thought, well, okay, the hominid niche is so unique, so particular, that there could be only one. And so the evolution of humanity and from our ancestry was seen as kind of a single line, with one species being succeeded by another, and then subsequently by another. You know, this single species hypothesis. Well, that the ink was just barely dry on the papers that were promoting that notion when it was discovered that there were multiple species coexisting in East Africa. Richard Leakey showed that there were Homo erectus and Homo habilis, and even robust Australopithecines living side by side. And now we know that in many sites there are, you know, as many as six or eight species of hominid. With each passing year, new discoveries keep adding additional species to this bush instead of a single tree trunk. And so there were many species contemporaneous. And then the flip side to that coin is that we've also been discovering many species that have persisted until much more recently than had ever been appreciated. There was just a jaw found off the coast of Taiwan just last year that was dredged up by a fisherman, and it's a Homo erectus. Homo erectus, or maybe Homo heidelbergensis, the species that immediately preceded us, Homo sapiens. But it was dated and was found to be less than 10,000 years old. Well, that's half as old as the youngest date that has been given for Homo erectus previously. There's a species of a specimen of Homo heidelbergensis found north of Beijing that dates between 10 and 20,000 years. There's a recently described Neanderthal site that was less than 10,000 years. So, you know, you only have to go back 10 or 15, 20,000 years into Asia, and you might encounter any one of a half a dozen different species that were living side by side with humans. So why would the present be any different than the past? I mean, why do we assume, in the face of so much evidence to the contrary, that we are the only ones, the only hominins now surviving? And there have been many books written with that very title. There's one by Chris Stringer, a paleoanthropologist at the British Museum of Natural History, called Lone Survivors. You know, and it's looking at this notion. And that has been the prevailing idea. Now, one event that kind of turned that on its ear, and I thought would have had much more impact, but it seems to, you know, it takes a lot more impact than just that. But the discovery of Homo floresiensis, the hobbit, the little tiny diminutive hominin that was discovered there in Indonesia and was dated to only between 13 and 18,000 years old, the youngest skeleton. Even Chris Stringer is quoted as saying, you know, when I first heard the stories of the discovery of Homo floresiensis, I immediately thought of the possible parallels to the orang pendek. Now, the orang pendek is the Malaysian term for a little 3-foot-tall, hair-covered hominin that presumably are scattered throughout the forests of Southeast Asia. Probably the same thing as what was found on Flores, the little hobbit. And so here was something, you know, and then the discoverers were even kind of coyly acknowledging that, well, actually, you know, the natives have been telling us stories about these little hairy people that live up in the mountains. And, in fact, some early European colonists here to Indonesia also reported encounters with such creatures, but they've been dismissed as, you know, misidentifications or just, you know, simple folklore. Now, maybe the possibility of a relic Australopithecine, which is the most likely candidate, either Australopithecine or early Homo habilis, living up until just, you know, the present, or at the very least, demonstrably, you know, 10 to 20,000 years ago, is a very real possibility. So the, Henry Gee, the managing editor of Nature, you know, one of the premier scientific journals in the world, in an editorial, noted that, with the discovery of this, maybe there's a kernel of truth to the stories of the Yeti or even the Sasquatch.
Well, let's take that. We have to go to a break. When we come back, let's start to discuss the positives for there being a species that may still exist on Earth that we haven't fully explored or been able to scientifically prove, and look at the theories against. Here's something that, you know, a lot of people will throw out there when they're making the case for Bigfoot not existing. And you just talked about the fact that we're finding more and more of these subsections of humans that have dwelled on the Earth, and these legends that seem to be living up to what we're finding now. The big case for there being no Bigfoot is, why have we not stumbled on a body? Why have we not stumbled on a carcass somewhere of one of these creatures? And that's a pretty plausible, or not plausible, but I think that's a pretty effective question. How do you explain why there's nothing, there's no bones, there's no skulls or hands or feet or anything to back up these claims in 2016? After all these years, we've never dug them up by accident.
Right. Well, as far as digging them up, as far as fossilization, there's a couple of things to keep in mind. What we understand as the likely habitat for these creatures is wet forests. That seems to be, you know, critical ingredient is, you know, they're usually seen very close to water. So, and so keep two things in mind. Let's talk about the ecology, the habitat in which they live in, and the natural history of the creature. If these creatures indeed exist, they must be extremely rare, and that would make sense for a large-bodied primate, one that has a slow, you know, if we can extrapolate reasonably from other existing great apes, they have a long lifespan, they have a slow development, slow reproductive rate. It doesn't take a lot of them to maintain a population. And so, you know, you've got to think in terms, always remind yourself we're talking about an extremely rare animal. You know, we have little bits and pieces of inferential evidence like that would suggest something like a home range maybe of 1,000 square miles. And in 1,000 square miles, you might have a male that, say, you know, they tend to be solitary, and that's based on the fact that most encounters are with single individuals, and most footprint finds are of single individuals, or a female, presumably female, with an offspring, a younger one, in tow. You know, some really interesting examples of little footprints in the company of a, you know, a 14, 15-inch foot. I have in my collection here, I've got footprints down to about, 3.5, 4 inches in length that have been documented in the field. And so, you know, if you went through a little exercise, say you looked, you combined those two types of factors, and you looked at the state of Idaho. I've got a map here on the wall here I'm looking at right now. And if I looked at that and I first just considered the areas that have, 16 to 18 inches of precipitation a year or more, enough to support some good wet forests. And then I imagine, you know, subdividing that up into, 1,000 square mile plots, I would come up with, depending on the topography and the forest cover and so forth, about 10, 12 of those reasonably in that are isolated enough from, you know, human traffic and so forth, human settlements and whatnot. And so if you imagine there's maybe, in each of those plots, there's a male and maybe a couple of females that share that territory, maybe an offspring or two. So 4 or 5, let's just say 5 for easier math, 5 times 12, there may be only 60 Sasquatch in all of the state of Idaho. And yet we know that there's probably, 20 to 30,000 black bear. Now, if you ask hunters or outdoorsmen, how often have they ever found a black bear carcass, a skull, out hiking about or walking about that died a natural death, that wasn't shot by a hunter, you know, or hit by a car on the side of the road and was left on the side of the road? And, you know, Dr. Krantz, my predecessor, used to do that every opportunity. I usually don't do it as religiously, just occasionally ask that question of my audiences, but he used to do it quite religiously, and in all the years he was asking that, not once did he have someone, who had found a bear remain like that. So if that's the case for bears, then why would we expect to stumble on a carcass? You know, if you've got 70 in the entire state, 60 or 70 in the entire state of Idaho, of those 70, how many of them of those 70 are in their golden years? Are close to death, because these animals would have no natural predators. They're going to die a natural death or an accident or disease. You know, there's potential as well. But you know.
Well, that's assuming that there are no natural predators. Lions, bears, poisonous snakes. They would, I would guess, a bite from a poisonous snake would have the same effect on a Sasquatch as it would on a bear or other animals, right?
Well, sure. Well, that's true. That's
so you're
true.
Going to have those opportunities, and if they're walking around barefoot in those areas, there's probably a higher risk and potential for them to be bitten, especially living in cave environments and walking through the wilderness. So you would automatically assume that that might be the case.
Well, that's true. You know, those are variables that would have to be taken into account as well. But still, you know, the rarity is one of the factors. And then the second, the other thing to bear in mind is that when an animal dies of whatever cause, then it's very quickly rendered down by the scavengers and decomposers and so forth. and what skeletal remains are exposed, aren't chewed up by the pack rats and porcupines and rodents. If they're exposed to the elements of a wet coniferous forest, particularly ones here in the Pacific Northwest that are also associated with volcanic soils, those factors lead to a very acidic environment where bones just do not survive very long if they're exposed to those elements. You know, a case in point is if you look at Gigantopithecus. You know, here's this giant ape, probably fairly rare as well, given its size and all. But yet we know from what scant fossils we have, and that consists for the biggest species, Gigantopithecus blackie, a species that had a duration of probably 1.5 million years. We have two jaws and about 1,000 isolated teeth. And the only reason we have those fossils is because porcupines carried the bones into caves, into limestone caves, and where they gnawed upon them down to the leaving the very thick enameled crowns and the thickest parts of a few jaws where they would be fossilized and later found by people harvesting the minerals there for fertilizer and whatnot. So, you know, there's a species, a giant ape, that we recognize as having existed based on the fossils that exist, and yet all we have to show for 1.5 million years of that species existing are just a handful of bones that we only have because of those two factors, limestone caves and the action of porcupines, the collecting and assemblage by porcupines.
We have to take a break. We'll come back and continue on this vein and thoughts. But what about the case for Native American tribes referring to these creatures that is spread out throughout the entire United States, not just in the wet forestry areas? We find fossilized remains of Native Americans. We find fossilized remains of cavemen. Why would we not eventually find or stumble upon the carcasses or I'm sorry, not carcasses, but the fossilized remains of Bigfoot in these drier areas, which would be more conducive? We'll talk about that possibility and so much more. Stay tuned. This is Darkness Radio.
Hey, folks, I want to talk to you about something real quick here, and that's about your credit card debt. You know, the average interest rate on credit card debt is over 19% APR. Have you looked at your interest rate lately on your credit card? You know, you don't need to be a financial expert to know that consolidating your debt into a low fixed rate can save you thousands in interest. So pay off your high interest credit cards with a credit card consolidation loan from LightStream. You can get a rate as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay, much lower than the national average interest rate on credit card debt. You can get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000 with absolutely no fees. The application is 100% online, which is nice and convenient, and you can even get your money as soon as the day that you apply. LightStream believes that when you have good credit, you deserve a low rate and great service. Right now, we have a special offer just for our listeners. And you can apply today at lightstream.com/darkness and get an additional interest rate discount. That's lightstream.com/darkness for an additional discount. LightStream.com/darkness. One more time, lightstream.com/darkness and get an additional interest rate discount when you apply. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.50% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/darkness for more information.
Good evening. Welcome back to the show. Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum, our guest this evening, as we try to demystify the legend of Bigfoot and look at the different stories and the case for and against this giant creature. Like I had mentioned before the break, there's many different Native American cultures around the United States that have talked about this, as some will refer to the wild man or the hairy man species. And in some cases, they say that they exist and they just stay away from them. But those seem to coincide with other versions of Native American culture throughout the United States, not just in the wet, moist, foresty regions, but in the dry, arid regions as well. What do you make of claims from the Native American tribes that seem to have seen this, but yet we find no burial grounds, no burial mounds, no bones, nothing?
Right. Well, one of the things, you know, let me just qualify this conversation again. I don't mean to sound authoritative or too assertive in what I'm saying, because we are just drawing inferences and trying to place it within a reasonable context. Many Native Americans have been quite mobile and have moved from place to place, and so traditions and knowledge or accounts that they
right.
have may not pertain to things that they are experiencing in the present. And then there is a difference in quality to the types of stories that different Native American groups have, depending upon the region of the continent that they're living in. Kathy Strain is an anthropologist, archaeologist with the U.S. Forest Service, who's written a fantastic book summarizing many of these accounts and has kind of made that sort of distinction. But and so that's one aspect. And, of course, people obviously are capable of surviving in areas that much more diverse types of areas than some species might be able to. I'm sure these animals are very generalized, and you know, it is, I think, misleading when, as you see on some TV documentaries and so forth, you see it stated that they are encountered in every single state in the Union, and that I think that needs to be qualified, that statement. There may be reports from every state in the Union, but I've not seen good evidence in the forums, corroborative evidence, that is, to claims of Bigfoot encounters from every state in the Union. The most credible claims seem to emanate from places where there is an ecological basis for such a creature to exist. They're remarkably coincident with the distribution of black bear. So remarkably coincident that, in fact, you know, that some skeptics have simply pointed out, well, there's your answer. They're just misidentifications of black bear encounters. And I'm sure that there are those types of misidentifications that do take place. I mean, people get enthusiastic. They see what they expect to see, and a flash of dark fur in the foliage may be interpreted as Sasquatch, unjustifiably. But so that, if you look at the distribution of black bear across North America, they are, of course, in the Pacific Northwest and the Intermountain West, and they across the Great Lakes area and down through the Appalachia into the Deep South and kind of button-hooked back up into the Four Corners area. And black bears, as large omnivores, are pretty versatile and generalized in their diets sufficiently that they can exploit some more marginal habitats. I think Sasquatch are the same way. And while, you know, as I pointed out, wet forests are probably their prime habitat, they may not be the exclusive ones.
So do you believe, Dr. Meldrum, that a species does coexist with us, that there truly is a Sasquatch, Bigfoot, Yeti, whatever you want to refer to them as, that they do currently exist?
I'm convinced of that, yes. I kind of shy from the term belief because it's such a loaded term in this field. The skeptics, the ideological skeptics, use that label, true believer, as a derogatory moniker, and belief in many people's minds connotes a position of faith, that is, the acceptance of something in the absence of evidence, or at least in the absence of conclusive proof. And while I'm not advocating that anyone accept the existence, I'm simply presenting the evidence. But that evidence has convinced me that, yes, there are these things. And I think not just the Sasquatch, but as we pointed out, we started off talking about the Orang Pendek, and as it's known by many other names, the Ndutu, the Ibugogo, and so forth. There's the Yeti you mentioned, which sometimes is used in a very generic sense, but traditionally or originally referred to a form in the Himalayan region which seems to be more ape-like even than the Sasquatch or the Orang Pendek. And then you've got stories of the Almas in Russia, which some have suggested might represent relic Neanderthals. Or now we can add to that group of closely related species the Denisovans, and perhaps even other types of pre-sapiens hominin, like Homo heidelbergensis. There's a form up in far eastern Siberia, which, you know, as a youngster when I first read those accounts, I kind of just dismissed that. There must be some sort of native. They're described as often wearing coats of skins and having spears, but extremely primitive. I mean, you know, literally Paleolithic in their behaviors, and maybe those are Heidelbergensis, Homo Heidelbergensis, for all we know.
Dr. Meldrum, I mean, there were so many people that were settling this country and taking notes in diaries of everything that they encountered, from Florida fauna to, you know, hairy beast and so on. Have we found any solid historical reference to Bigfoot population or Bigfoot encounters that aren't just perhaps blown out myth and misunderstandings?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the stories that's often pointed to is the narrative of David Thompson, that was a famous explorer of the Canadian West. And he notes encountering some very large, what appeared to be bipedal footprints that he couldn't... that he couldn't account for. You know, here's someone who's probably been very experienced with the sign of large bears, and yet this was odd enough that he thought it worthwhile or justified making note of it, particular note of it in his narrative. So yeah, there've been people who have had encounters. Teddy Roosevelt, you know, these are the classic stories that I'm sure many have heard, that recounts a story that was shared with him that occurred here in my neck of the woods up in the Bitterroot Mountains on the boundary between Idaho and Montana, the story of a unfortunate encounter between a couple of trappers and what seemed to be fit the description of a Sasquatch from their recounting, or his recounting. The only one survived, apparently. Well, the second one was dispatched, as the story goes. So there are those sorts of historical encounters, and of course there's there are actually some
now is that but with the Teddy Roosevelt, was that a first-hand account, or was that him retelling something that he had heard from friends?
That was a retelling of a grizzled old trapper, as he described him, related his experience to Teddy, and Teddy was impressed enough to include it in his volume called The Wilderness Trapper. It's interesting now with the ability to search old newspapers that have been digitized and so forth. There are a number of books. One's by a fellow named Scott McLean, where he has just brought together lots and lots of newspaper accounts that span from the eastern states through the areas that we talked about earlier. Of course, they didn't have the word Sasquatch back then, or Bigfoot, but stories about wild men, particularly, or gorillas, or things like that encountered in the woods. So, yeah, there is a historical record. And then, of course, you know, you alluded to the Native American traditions, that they go back to the, their earliest recollections, and these figures play a prominent role in their worldview, in their traditional knowledge. In fact, you know, the wild man figure, I'm working on a second book here, and I was here in the office today looking up some references to the medieval European traditions of wild men. And these things are universal. No, I shouldn't say that. These things are widespread. I always hesitate to say, to use something as broad as universal, because they're not.
Right.
If they were universal, then you could easily sort of dismiss them as just some archetype of the, you know, human psyche, that every culture has its expression of a wild man. And that's not the case. There still seems to be a geographic, an ecological correlation. These stories are most entrenched, most established in areas where now, today, we have a biological basis or an ecological basis for the existence of such a creature. We don't have them out in the middle of the Sahara Desert, they're Bedouins out there don't see hairy wild men running around. But, a fascinating illustration of that principle struck me when I was thumbing through a magazine article one time on an airplane and coming back from a trip, and there was an article about the imperiled status of the Asian tiger. And what struck me was the graphic they had, the map, showing the former and the present distribution of the tiger across Asia. At one time they spanned from the Caucasus all the way, to Siberia and throughout Southeast Asia. And that they showed that distribution as of 1900. Then in highlighted upon that, they had the fragmented refugia that now exist within as of 1990. And what struck me was, prior to this, I had been collecting examples of footprints attributed to Sasquatch-like creatures, described as being 6 to 8 feet tall, covered with hair, leaving large humanoid footprints with a non-divergent big toe, et cetera, et cetera. And as I looked at this map, the examples that I have found from China, from Indonesia, from India, from the Caucasus, from the mountains flanking the Gobi Desert, the Altai, Tian Shan, and those up through there, every one of these coincided with one exception, coincided with the distributions of tigers. Now, it's not that there's a magical relationship between tigers and giant humanoid or hominoids, but rather, again, it comes back to that ecological factor, that the wet forests that tigers prefer and where their remaining range now persists is also the type of habitat that apparently supports the existence of
right. We've got about a minute and a half left in this segment. Ralph Molesworth says, Dr. Meldrum, what's the chance that they were once much more common and that what we are now witnessing is just a creature on the verge of extinction?
Well, that's very possible. And even the Native American stories talk about that. I'm going down to New Mexico, to the University of New Mexico, to give a talk in a couple of weeks. And down there, the natives say that these ancient ones were once much more widespread, this race of giant hairy people, they refer to them. But now they're no longer.
But as you pointed out, they're really kind of more of the apex predator. They're more of the top of the food chain here. If there's nobody really hunting them, there's nobody really wiping them out, where is this species going?
Well, it's probably there is still encroachment, just as we saw with the tiger. I mean, it's same. You could say the same thing for that tiger. That tiger's an apex predator, and yet habitat degradation and population expansion, I'm sure, is having some impact.
Right, but tigers are also heavily hunted for their pelts and for different medicinal purposes. Right. I mean, there's been all these beliefs behind that.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. There is that pressure that we can't attribute to these. But I mean, I think the biggest impact in this case was. As demonstrated by this map graphic, was the loss of habitat.
All right, we have to take our break. We have Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum with us for the next hour. We know where our guest stands on the belief that this does exist, but I'll ask him when we return to look at the other scope and what are the points that make him question the existence of these beings. We'll do that and so much more on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio.
Yeah. If you like our show, you're going to love Rob Has a Podcast on Podcast One. Join the biggest reality TV podcast around as Survivor's Rob Cesternino covers the current season of Celebrity Big Brother and more. Download Rob Has a Podcast every week on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back to today's encore presentation of Beyond the Darkness, the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Tim Dennison for Dave Schrader on this Memorial Day weekend Saturday edition. I know you're normally used to Supernatural News and Parashare, but today we've got a special encore presentation with Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum. We're talking about demystifying Bigfoot and actually making a case for Bigfoot. I've got my, I almost said pocket Bigfoot. That doesn't sound right. It sounds like something you'd pick up at an adult store. I've got my emergency Bigfoot here, my Archie McPhee emergency Bigfoot, which I got from my friend Amanda over in Wisconsin. And no, she didn't have to skin a Bigfoot, much like you'd get from Ed Gein. But this is actually just a pocket Bigfoot. That sounds so disgusting. Yeah, I've named him Biggie. So we've been sitting here listening to the program along with you guys, and he's been chiming in from time to time. What do you think of your name, Biggie? He seems to agree. He likes it. He likes Biggie as a name. But we've been listening along with you, and we get into the second part of the program here, and it takes a turn for the better here as we start to really get into the theory behind Bigfoot and why Dr. Meldrum thinks that Bigfoot exists. And we get into it now. Dave and Dr. Meldrum go back and forth, and it starts to get pretty tense in the conversation between the two. I do want to forewarn you, though, the ending of this program is the most stressful, most terse, most abrupt that you'll hear in Beyond the Darkness and Darkness Radio history. You heard it here first. In fact, you'll just get one of these from Biggie. Yeah, at the end. That's what you'll get. You'll find out when you hear the very end. Don't skip ahead. It's like the monster at the end of the book. Don't skip ahead to the end of the show to hear it. Just listen all the way through. Just be a good little listener and listen all the way through. Here's part two of our interview with Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum on the best in paranormal talk radio. Here's Beyond the Darkness, part two with Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum.
Welcome back to the show. This evening, our guest, Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum. Tonight, we're making the case for Bigfoot. Could this giant hominid bipedal creature truly exist alongside us in this day and age? With all the technology and encroachment, could there still be a species that we have not identified? Dr. Meldrum, I know we talked a little bit in the first hour about your belief that, yes, you believe it does exist and that this does happen to be there. What do you think are some of the best points on the other side of how this couldn't possibly be something that, that is still part of our world?
Well, obviously the common lines of objection have some merit when taken in the proper perspective, but I mean they all need to be kept in perspective, and that's the thing I think where we lose. But you know, we just finished this discussion about where are the bones and the body, and you know, it's frustrating that we have been unable to get DNA from tissues, and we've had some disappointing and downright misleading investigations undertaken that have produced disappointing results, I think inconclusive results. it's funny.
Well, let's talk about that. Dr. Melba Ketchum has taken quite a bit of heat over the last few years regarding a DNA testing that was done on what was believed to be a part of a Bigfoot that was brought back. And I know, I believe we had those two guys on our show talking about their supposed moment of shooting a Bigfoot and going back to find the parts. Why don't you, for recap, kind of tell us a little bit about that story and where the evidence supposedly came from and what the overall outcome was?
Right. Well, she, Dr. Ketchum, who is a veterinarian, she has a company, several companies. One of her companies, the one that she made me aware of when we first met, was a genetics company, a pedigree, basically, a service that primarily to establish pedigrees for show dogs and racehorses. But she got interested, it seemed, so it appeared, in this subject out of intellectual curiosity, and she thought she offered her services. She received numerous, I think it's on the order of like 100, 112 or something, some number, of samples, all of which produced, she claimed, DNA results. But she focused on three samples where she did whole genomic DNA, where she had sampled large numbers of fragments from the DNA recovered from those samples. And one of those, which figured centrally in her study, was from this kill site of Justin Shmea in the Sierras of California. And I had some firsthand involvement with that incident, not the initial claim, but a colleague of mine became quite intrigued with Justin's story, and his enthusiasm was contagious, and he convinced me to, invited me, I should say, didn't take any convincing, given his enthusiasm, he invited me to come the following spring. So the story went, Justin, they were out actually poaching bear, as I understand it, and they encountered what he claimed was an adult Sasquatch and shot it against the, in spite of the protests of his companion, who was afraid that maybe they were shooting a monster movie on this, in the area, on location. And
right, which I think is important for people to realize. It sounds kind of dismissive as we giggle a little bit about it, but the fact is, when we had him on the show, he admitted that he saw it, scoped it, and in the matter of seconds took a shot at it, even though his friend was protesting and saying, we don't know if that's not a human dressed in something.
Right.
There was no hesitation for Smeya to shoot and try to kill something he didn't know that what it was. And I think that's really
he's illegally poaching.
Right. Right.
And so I got the account straight from the horse's mouth. When I arrived on the scene, the first thing that Justin did was walk us through the whole scenario on site. And so I could watch him, watch the way he told his story, how it related to the surroundings, etc. And there were just, I was not impressed with it from the get-go, and he could sense that, I'm sure, because he was quite defensive in regarding me and my attitude towards it. But the account was just odd. I had been given the impression that we were going up there to look for the remains of after the winter had transpired. We looked for the remains of the adult one. That he had actually seen it and then was frightened by its human appearance and had abandoned it, and that we were going to back and see if we could recover any of the remains. Well, it turns out that wasn't the case. They, even though he claims he shot it, they never claimed to have examined or to have found the body of the adult. But then they were accosted by these two small ones, and his description of them was very odd. They were about 3 feet tall. He said they had a head the size of a 5-gallon bucket, in his words, that looked like a cross between a black person and a gorilla. And they were jumping around, these two, presumably twins or close in age, and they were running in and out of the brush. And then finally at one point, and during all this, apparently he had separated from his partner. His partner, who was unarmed, they're out there looking for an 800-pound giant hairy ape that is wounded, presumably, and his partner goes off on his own without a firearm. I mean, that alone should raise a red flag in the credibility of the story.
And according to Smea's report when he was on our show, his friend again said, "Do not shoot these things.
Yeah.
Just hold tight. I'll be right back." And the minute his friend left and one popped its head up, he shot it.
Exactly. Yeah. So he claims.
Right.
So he claims. And so, you know, so we were looking. So we scoured. In fact, you know, when we had.
Well, just so we clarify, too, when he said he shot another adult-sized one and then felt bad and then took a shot at the kid. It rolled down to his feet, and then guilt overtook him, and that's when they decided to bury it. So he missed the first one he killed, he refused to bring back. The second one he killed, he refused to bring back, then felt guilty and thought he should really prove that these exist. So he killed the minor and then decided not to share that one either and buried all of these characters. So,
well, and he actually didn't bury. What he did is they and it wasn't because of the guilty feelings. They had seen a Forest Service vehicle earlier, and so they were afraid that they might be stumbled upon by this ranger out patrolling, and so he pitched it. He pitched it into the alders because he showed us where he threw it, and we scoured. Like I said, we were down our hands and knees crawling underneath these alders and all through, literally in the creek bottom there, looking for any bones, any remains, you know, just to cover our bases. I had arranged and had on site a dog handler, a search and recovery dog handler, with her dogs. She, you know, you can't. All she was going to do, she agreed to. She was quite intrigued by this whole prospect, but she said, "All I can do is let the dogs out, and while they're not on task and they're looking around, I can watch their body language. If they stumble across something that's unusual to them." That's unfamiliar, they'll react, and I'll know that. But she can't, you know, she can only put them to task on something that they have been trained for. But when I got up there, they were not supposed to have been on site until I arrived. But instead, they were already there, including Bobo with his pet dog, Monkey, who was running all over hill and dale. And so the dog handler, when she saw the situation, she didn't even let her dogs out. They know the area was completely contaminated, so we didn't have an opportunity to try that. But in any case, I thought it would have been for naught, I'm quite sure. Because as this progressed, the search was obviously futile, and we were kind of discouraged. And I, you know, there was bear sign all over the place. There were tracks galore. In fact, you know, I brought lots of plaster in case we did find any sign, I took advantage and brought home some great examples for my comparative collection of bear tracks. But in any case, at this point, we're back reconvened in camp, and to try to recover a little bit, Justin reaches in his pocket and pulls out a Ziploc bag, and he had a little postage stamp sized piece of hide, and they make very clear, you know, in the chit chat about this, it's been referred to as the stake. There, I mean, I saw photos of what he dug up from the snow, and it was not. There was no meat on it, so nothing that could be referred to as a steak. It was a piece of hide with hair attached. You know, skin with hair attached, fur to be specific, not hair but fur. And he had cut a little square of this and salted it so he could carry it around and show it to people. And he hands this to me, and I always carry a little loop, a little geologist loop. I had a 15 power loop, and I. You know, it's not quite a microscope, but I could get a good close look at this, and I immediately just looked at it. It looked straight in his face, and I said, I could see guard hairs and under fur. It was not primate hair. And I said to him, this is not primate hair. And he immediately started backpedaling. So, I never said this was Bigfoot. I said, I just said this is what I dug up here when the dog, you know, his bear dog, bear hunting dog, had acted excited about. And so, and this was a very important point, because then subsequently two people had it independently tested, and both university laboratories determined it was bear. Now, this was a problem because this sample, when Melba got her hands on it, she was reportedly doing back handsprings, in her words, because this was produced such good DNA, and it was absolutely consistent with all the other samples. Now, she had received, you know, lots of hair samples. She received a nail, you know, a toenail, I think it was. There was a piece, fragment of bone. And supposedly all of these were producing DNA. And I thought, well, how is this? You know, I've looked at lots of hair, and I've had hair tested. You know, people have sent me samples. In fact, when Dr. Sykes was getting samples, I offered to screen some samples for him. I didn't want him to waste his time and money, you know, on just whatever, because people go out and pick up hair, not realizing that hair is extremely durable and persists out there in the environment for a long, long, long time. So even if you have a legitimate encounter, just because you walk over to that tree it was standing behind and find a piece of hair doesn't mean that it came from what you saw. It could have been there for years. But in any case, when I got samples sent to me, 4 out of 5 of them could immediately be eliminated because they could be identified as from common forms of wildlife, just misidentified. They're guard hairs, they're, you know, of a canid, of a deer or elk or whatever. And so how is it that every single sample that Melba got produced Sasquatch DNA? And even the sample of bear hair and hide that she got produced Sasquatch DNA. So, you know, honestly, as far as I'm concerned, there just is no credibility to any of the claims that Melba has, Dr. Ketchum has made. I have yet to see anything. I mean, we could talk all night about the whole chain of events, the claim that it was reviewed, and the paper, the manuscript, that it, you know, the purchasing of a journal and renaming it and self-publishing your paper. I mean, just the whole procedure is the least scientific. There have been a number
And have you read her papers and research on this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, one of the funny things, this is one of the things that just made me laugh, was she published a dendrogram, a graph, a, you know, branching tree that showed various samples, and lo and behold, the unknown falls right next to a Galago crassicadensis, I think is what the species was, but that's a prosimian, a bush baby. And she made, and then I saw where she talked during an interview. She made the comment that yes, they were surprised at the proximity of this sample to the affinity of the sample to this prosimian. But then she said we discovered that at one time there was a 450-pound lemur on the island of Madagascar. Well, what in the world does that mean? So, you know, her scenario is that she's got this hybrid that was spawned by a cross between a pre-sapiens hominin of some kind and a Homo sapiens female dating back to about 15,000 years is her scenario. Now, all of a sudden, it could be a European female pre-European, I guess, but you know, from European continent, female crossing with a 450-pound giant lemur from Madagascar. I mean, how did this coupling take place and produce an entire species of a sustained species? I mean, it's just, you know, it borders on ludicrous. It's just, you know, how can you take anything else?
And I think it's important for people to realize too, Dr. Meldrum wants proof. He wants to believe that Bigfoot exists. He wants there to be definitive proof so that his research and life's work is recognized as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
yeah,
it's
yeah. You know, I would be her biggest fan club and this was always funny because of course then if there's any criticism I'm derided as being jealous. See, I feel like I've been scooped. Like she she's taken the limelight away from me. And I, you know, that's the farthest thing. Anyone, if you just stop and think about it, just as you said, I would, my 20 years of effort would be justified, and I'd be in a much better position to continue doing the kind of field research. I mean, once we recognize that such a creature exists, the work really starts, because we still have to study and find. You know, it's not going to become suddenly any easier. There isn't going to be a Jane Goodall moment where you can go and sit on a hillside. Not that, I mean, I don't mean to diminish the accomplishment that Jane Goodall did, but her subjects were social, were gregarious, were loud, were confined to one small little reserve by comparison to the vastness of the Pacific Northwest, the Western United States and Canada. You know, that's not going to, we're not going to have a situation like that. There isn't going to be a Jane Goodall or a Diane Fossey who goes out and communes with these solitary, far-ranging creatures, largely nocturnal in their behaviors, it seems, or potentially largely nocturnal. And so it's going to take, we're going to have to take the study to the next step. We're going to have to begin employing technologies like airships, drones, you know, UAVs that can get up there and survey large areas. Until such time, either that or discover something that's just an irresistible attractant that brings it in, them in, so that we can tag them and then follow them, you know, track them and see what their behaviors are and their social structure and all these other things that are necessary to understand their ecology and behaviors.
No real evidence in a DNA or hair, fibers, scat, bone, nothing that we can, without a shadow of a doubt, say proves that Bigfoot exists.
Well, of course, if you qualify it with that criteria, no. But we do have hair, for example. Dr. Henner Fehrenbach kind of led the charge. He's now retired, and I've tried to kind of pick up, at least on the basis of the hair morphology. You know, I've done molecular sequencing in the past in primate studies, but not to the extent that I'm up on all the latest techniques and generating sequence is one aspect. Interpreting the sequence is a whole other thing, and that's been one of the large criticisms of Melba's project as well, is she's not interpreted what data she has garnered, if indeed she has, and I believe that there have been some legitimate sequences, but they just are not anything pointing to a hybrid species that she has interpreted it as. But we have hair samples that defy attribution to any other known form of wildlife that are essentially primate. The only other possibility is that they're misidentified hair, we've been unable to get DNA from these because one of the characteristics that distinguishes these from most human hair is the lack of a cellular medulla. Now, in some individuals, that occurs as well. It's not a mysterious, you know, occurrence. It's just that it's in the lack of a cellular medulla, that central core. All you have then is the keratin shaft, this extracellular matrix of protein that doesn't have a lot of DNA. It doesn't have nuclei and mitochondria that harbor the DNA. And so most hair samples that don't have an active follicle, the active root, there isn't a whole lot of DNA in there, and it's really a challenge to get any DNA material. So far, we have not been successful in getting DNA. That was another red flag, is Melba claimed that she had a hair specialist. She never would identify him, and there never was a paper, the promised paper, that was describing the hair. She claimed that the hair that she had Sasquatch DNA from had a very obvious medulla, and that doesn't seem to be the case. None of the samples that I've seen that weren't easily attributed to other wildlife had a cellular medulla. So we do have some physical evidence, but it's not, you know, as you say, it's not conclusive proof. In this day and age, you've got to have DNA. There just isn't the hair sample. The hair alone is not sufficient. But we've got the footprints. You know, that's my forte, and that's the most persuasive, you know, for me personally, in part or to a large measure because that's what I'm most familiar with.
Well, let's cover that when we return. I want to dig into that because we've heard of the footprints. We've heard of people collecting footprints for years. And then was the advent of the dermal ridge, which seemed to be setting it apart from possible fake Bigfoot tracks. It may have been boards tied to the bottom of regular shoes that were in the shape of large human feet. What is the dermal ridge? Is this truly a phenomena that is attributed to creatures that we could prove that this is in fact some form of beast and not just again a faked piece of evidence? We'll talk with our guest about that when we return. Stay tuned. We've got more with Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum and researching, investigating, and the case for Bigfoot next on Darkness Radio.
60 seconds. That's exactly how long this commercial lasts. You want to know what else you can do in about a minute? You can get an offer for your car with TrueCar. That's right. In the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, or do a few sit-ups, or just listen to my dreamy, creamy, dulcet tones, you can also get a true cash offer. But best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or your home. You just go to TrueCar, simply enter your license plate number, and watch how your car's details pop up. Just answer a few questions, and you'll get an accurate true cash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring in your car, and they'll check it out with you together. You can ask questions and get all the answers you need so there's no surprises. Then, just simply leave with your check or trade in your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today.
Welcome back to the show. Little Beast of Burden, Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum, our guest this evening, as we talk about making the case for Bigfoot. We've talked about some of the flaws, the fly in the ointment, if you will. No DNA, no real proof. But one of the things that's been prevalent through all of these investigations are the footprints. So many different footprints, so many different locations. And let's talk about footprints and the dermal ridge, Dr. Meldrum. What is a dermal ridge? And does that actually play a part in differentiating between a fake footprint and a real footprint?
Only a very small part.
Okay.
And that is because the preservation of dermal ridges is very rare. You know, I have 250-plus casts now in my laboratory collection, and of those, there's only about half a dozen that show discernible ridge detail, and that's simply because the conditions have to be very particular in order to transfer the ridge pattern from the foot to the substrate. That means the substrate has to be of fine enough particulate matter and the right consistency, and then it has to survive until discovered, and these can be very transient. Gravity and wind and weather will flatten those out and obliterate those fine details very quickly, in a matter of hours, actually, and if the weather is not cooperative. And then the person preserving the footprint has to be careful enough to either consolidate that track, particularly if it's in fine dust, for example, or make sure that the mix is just the right consistency that it will pick up and not obliterate that fine detail and transfer it to the plaster cast. So there aren't very many, and the significance, while the significance is high for those individual cases, and Dr. Krantz drew attention to these a long time ago, but it sort of fell on deaf ears. It just did not, again, the old adage, justifiable or not, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidences. And so the notion that even though you've got this evidence that is extremely persuasive to latent fingerprint examiners, for example, in forensic units, the anthropological community was not ready to receive it because of the implication of what it would mean if they did acknowledge it as legitimate. I mean, that would mean that there really was something out there which they could not could not accommodate. And so,
but why is that such a bad thing? I mean, you know, if I understand this correctly, too, and I'm sure you'll correct me quickly, the great apes were kind of a myth not even 120 years ago.
Oh, exactly. Exactly.
And that was kind of all, you know, there's no way that these things could exist, but they did, and there's proof of it. And it's only been about 120 years, I think it is.
Exactly. And if you look at the narratives of the history of the discovery and unfolding of an understanding of the gorilla, for example, and just substitute the word Sasquatch for gorilla, they ring remarkably familiar. We're going through that same process, I think. Dr. John Bindernagel has written a great book called The Discovery of Sasquatch. And his thesis is that Sasquatch has been discovered, it just has not been recognized. And he shows how we're going through, science is going through the same process that it struggled with to acknowledge the existence of the gorilla, for example. But
why is there such a reluctance to look at these things? I mean, you know, all of breakthroughs happen when you look outside the box, when you're willing to accept the fact that what we know may not be reality. Why would anybody at this point, when we're realizing that places like Papua New Guinea is this enriched land of flora, fauna, and creatures that we thought extinct or that never existed, we're finding proof that they still exist right here on our planet. Why would we be putting the rest of this aside?
Well, science has always been very conservative, and that serves it well to a point. But when that conservatism is so dictated by prevailing paradigms, like this single species hypothesis, you know, I mean, that was finally overturned. But the idea of what I refer to as relic hominoids, of persistent lineages of this bushy hominoid tree, both, you know, human ancestors and our close relatives, the great apes, that idea is just starting to get some traction. I mean, recently, New Scientist magazine, which is a popular British popular science magazine, had a story, a cover story entitled "The 10 Top Questions Puzzling, you know, Researchers of Human Evolution Today," and one of those questions was, "Are other hominins alive today?" So the notion is at least getting some attention and some discussion. As I said, the discovery of Homo floresiensis has put kind of a different spin on the possibility. I mean, suddenly people are talking about, you know, first it was just assumed that this was an evolved adapted Homo erectus. They tried to fit it into where they would anticipate, you know, what was out there, what was known to be out there already. But then, you know, I was asked to review the paper, the original Nature paper that described these remains. I reviewed that paper for another journal, and I kind of went out on a limb there, and I said, these limb bones look more like Australopithecines. They look much more pongid, like more ancient than what we'd expect for a Homo erectus. And now That's the accepted dogma now, that they do. They are most likely relic Australopithecines or very early Homo habilis. And the boundary there, the transition from Australopithecine to, you know, Homo habilis or Homo rudolfensis, these small, very early Homo, is pretty gray. But the point is to think that 10 years ago, anyone would consider that there could be a relic population of late Australopithecine, early Homo, as recently as 13,000 years ago in Southeast Asia, they would have laughed you out of the room. But I was at the physical anthropology meetings, and that's exactly what the commentator was saying from the podium. And I'm, you know, this is like 2 years after I said in my review that, hey, this skeleton, these things aren't Homo erectus, these are something else. So, I mean, you can't argue really for Homo when you've got a brain that's the size of a chimpanzee, even when you're 3 feet tall. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. But anyway, we now know that Australopithecines even were capable of making simple stone tools, Stone Tool record and cutting of flesh from bones now goes back past 3 million years, and so it's there weren't Homo around at that time, at least not that we know of. But that's the thing. You know, so the part of the problem is, you know, back in 1967, go back to the Patterson-Gimlin film that we started off with, when that was plopped into the laps of these unsuspecting anthropologists who had ignored, most of whom had ignored the stories about Bigfoot as just stories, or of you know, the stories of Sasquatch in Canada. It was actually the Canadian academics who first provided a venue for examining the Patterson-Gimlin film. They didn't know what to make out of it. You know, I find it so amusing, actually, in hindsight, that one of the prominent, actually, this was one of the Smithsonian staff, I can't remember which scientist it was, but he said, look at this combination of features. From the waist up, it looks like a gorilla. From the waist down, it looks like a hairy human. It's inconceivable that such a combination, such a mosaic of features would exist in nature. This was in 1967. This was before we knew what the skeleton of an Australopithecine would look like. And what did it look like? Well, from the waist up, it looked like it from like a chimpanzee. From the waist down, it looked like a hairy, short-legged human. Inconceivable that such a combination exists, but guess what? It did. You know, so Bigfoot actually anticipated in the combination of features of a large bipedal primate characteristics that were yet to be discovered 10 years down the road, literally. And there's lots of things, actually, aspects about Sasquatch that and both anatomies and behaviors that people thought, well, that's really weird, you know. I mean, for example, Sasquatch are always stealing salmon from the smokehouses and the drying racks of the Native Americans, you know. But wait a minute, primates don't eat fish.
Well, if that's a truism, and we know that that's what they do, why is there not a camera somewhere watching this?
Oh, well, there are. But, I mean, you know, the use of trail cameras has been completely unsuccessful. Well, at least as far as capturing a conclusive, convincing photograph, there's some iffy ones out there. But we now have a growing. In fact, I was just collecting a few of the papers for a little editorial I was writing. There's a growing literature now. In fact, there's a whole book that's been published on the use of game cameras, and they have demonstrated that they are quite visible to most wildlife. They pick up on the sounds they make, the light they leak, not to mention the human sense and the novelty of some new object, you know, in their familiar backyard, so to speak. For all those cameras, it's not that surprising if you have a fairly intelligent, rare, elusive animal that that we haven't found the moving needle in a haystack with the game cameras.
Well, with that said, though, they're seen walking across roads. That obviously they're aware that those roads are traversed by cars or vehicles, and people are around those areas. It would seem that if they're so intelligent to avoid game cams, why are they crossing the road? And if you say to get to the other side, Dr. Meldrum, we're done. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I know that, and that's very true. I can't jump into the head of a Sasquatch. I guess perhaps those headlights aren't seen as much a threat as something that smells like a human that they're unfamiliar with. I don't know, but it is true. Roads and streams. If you want to see a Sasquatch, your best chances are on a road or close to a body of water, a creek or a lake shore. That's the highest percentage of encounters. So.
Dr. Meldrum, footprints. We follow them, they trail along, and then suddenly and mysteriously disappear. Have they beamed up? Where are these Bigfoot going, and how do they disappear without leaving a trail waning off somewhere?
Well, I have repeatedly, not frequently, but repeatedly have had people make such claims that they start and stop, inexplicably. and yet they've never been able to document that. I've never seen anyone show me a case, a clear case, someone, and particularly someone who has any experience tracking. You know, I mean, anybody who goes out and follows a trail, an obvious set of footprints, say of their pet in the backyard, more likely than not will have a point where they can't find the next track. And even professional trackers, you know, struggle with that when tracking people or tracking wildlife, hunters, professional trackers. So, I mean, much too much mystery has been placed on that kind of that sort of thing.
But there have been photographs where, even in snow, they will follow a set of footprints, and then literally it's step, 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 nothing. There's no stream for them to have crossed over. There's no tree for them to have leapt upon. But they're gone. What do you make of cases like that, or do you think that those are
the only ones like that I've seen, or you know, such photos as you mentioned? It's obvious that there has been, for example, just drift that obliterates the tracks at a certain point. If there really were these kinds of things, I would be puzzling over them much more than I mm-hmm. presently am, because I just have not seen any case of such. That, you know, there was one, Joel Harden was a famous Border Patrol tracker who investigated some of the track claims in the Blue Mountains outside of Walla Walla, Washington. Paul Freeman, in particular, the case where he reported an encounter and tracks were at the scene. And he made the comment that was why he thought that they were faked, is because that the footprints could be followed for a distance and then they were gone. Well, given his reputation, it should have been obvious then that if it was a matter of somebody with a pair of crudely carved wooden feet strapped to some hiking boots, that at the point that they decided to stop and had to unstrap or sit down and take off their artificial feet and walk away, that it should have been pretty obvious that was the case, and yet he didn't assert that. He didn't find any sign that they were that there was a human involved. It's just I'm quite sure that the leaf litter, or the pine cone, pine needle litter, or the dry ground, or whatever. We had one interesting case where an individual had claimed to have been repeatedly finding footprints, and they were interesting because they were human-sized. He wasn't finding big, you know, 13, 14, 15-inch tracks. These were 8 inches and 10 inches, respectively. There was a pair of them that he had cast repeatedly, and sometimes in very remote areas, is what he claimed. And we had a case where we actually had a film crew. One of the Monster Quest episodes we were down, it was called Sierra Sasquatch. So they were filming this ultralight, and we had some time off, so we went, this gentleman took us, myself and my colleague John Mianzinski, took us over to show us some of these tracks that he had seen recently. Well, we ended up on a beach next to a little reservoir that was developed, had a parking lot, it had bathrooms and changing rooms, cinder block buildings, and the beach was covered with footprints. And he points out these ones, and sure enough, they were the same feet. I mean, you could recognize it was the same 8 and 10 inch individuals. Well, I simply backtracked the one, and it led right back to a boulder. And right there where those tracks stopped, the boulder was approached, and straddling that, the actual initiation of the footprints, were a couple of waffle-printed hiking boot prints.
Oh, gotcha.
Then I turned to this fellow, and I said, don't you see are you connecting the dots here? I said, how can you continue to think that these are anything other than people out recreating barefoot when you've got this right in front of you? Unfortunately, I snapped pictures of the thing myself and documented it photographically, but the cameramen, when they came later that afternoon, a big storm had built up, and the wind was so strong, it actually pushed the water from the reservoir, pushed it up like high tide against
right.
the upper end of the reservoir, and washed out the prints altogether.
One last question for you, Dr. Meldrum, and we've got a minute left, so I don't mean to pressure you, but Tim, go ahead.
Real quickly, Dr. Meldrum, in the interest of protecting your research, protecting your reputation, we've talked a little bit about TV shows throughout the last couple of hours. There was a show that you were on called Bigfoot Captured, and Dave came up with the topic for it. For lack of a better term, some people call it a fakeumentary, where it's film footage and then real cuts. How do you justify doing a show like that, yet still protecting your research?
Well, you have to realize that that when I'm approached by a producer, I try my darndest to get a good sense of what the motivation is, what the intent is, what the scope is, who else they're interviewing, you know, how they're going to depict and approach the subject. In this case, this thing, you know, I participated in this. It was over a year and a half ago that we did the filming for that. And at that time, he had mentioned that, amongst other things, no title had been decided on. Amongst other things, they said that they were thinking of doing some kind of a dramatization, and he wanted a capturing of the Sasquatch to introduce the notion or the conversation around the question: what would happen? What would be the chain of events, and what would be the implications? How would science react? How would you react? You know, and we had some conversation about that in the interview. I didn't see any of that on the show, but I had no idea that they were going to build the entire show around that. I mean,
See, folks, just like that, we run right up against time constraints, and that's the end of the interview. Sorry. That's what technology did. It just cut the interview right there. We had Dr. Meldrum kind of a little bit up against the ropes. We had asked him the question about, you know, the fakeumentary, and he was kind of, you know, bobbing and weaving a little bit, and he was trying to explain himself as to why he would make that kind of documentary-style program, and he was explaining himself and trying to get himself out of it, and we just asked the question at the wrong time. We probably should have asked it a little bit earlier in the interview, but there it was. Sorry, Biggie. I know. Well, that'll do it for today. I mean, I hope you guys enjoyed that interview. It was pretty pretty informative, and Dr. Meldrum did himself good in that interview. And Dr. Meldrum, of course, is a walking encyclopedia when it comes to cryptids, and when it comes to Bigfoot, and his research is very fascinating, along with Dr. Ketchum. We hope to have him back on, or actually at least Dr. Ketchum back on relatively soon. I know Dr. Ketchum, in the time since we've done this interview, she's had quite a few breakthroughs, so we're hoping to have Dr. Ketchum back on Beyond the Darkness sometime soon. So that'll do it for today. Tomorrow, it's going to be Happy Days. Here on Beyond the Darkness, we'll have our encore presentation with Anson Williams, and we'll go way back into the past when Henry Winkler made an appearance here on the program. So we'll have the Fonz and we'll have Potsy. We'll do a little Happy Days here on Beyond the Darkness. For Dave Schrader, I'm Tim Dennis, and of course, for Biggie, have a great Saturday, everybody, and if you get a chance today, be sure to tune in to AEW's Double or Nothing and say hey to Chris Jericho for us, and see his inaugural match there in AEW All Elite Wrestling. And have a great Saturday, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow right here on the best in Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Riley Herbst from 2311 Racing here, and you know what grinds my gears? Waiting for coffee. But instead of counting frappes and lattes, I fire up Chumba Casino. No apps, no fuss, just fun social casino games to pass the time. By the time my coffee's ready,
order for Riley.
I've already taken a few victory laps. Next time you're stuck waiting, make it entertaining. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.